there's something beyond this, you know, and there's a consciousness. Even, and this is part of what we recognize with the UAPs too, right? I mean, if anyone who's had a personal connection with a UAP, there was definitely a consciousness connection going on, right? And their technology was able to pick up on it. Mm-hmm. Right? And so we were being drawn to each other. Well, that suggests, again, that we're living in a matrix of consciousness.
Yeah.
And once you wake up to that, you know, you're no longer bound by it in the same way. And you also recognize these greater possibilities. And so in a way, those UAPs are helping us to wake up and escape in that regard. I used to work for the Space Labs up in Boulder, Colorado. And we were working on a classified project at the time. It's going to happen at some point, possibly within our lifetimes. And so even though we have this incredible technology that's developing more every day, it's also, the more dependent we are on it, the more in trouble we're going to be if something like that happens.
What do you find yourself thinking about the most these days?
You know, where we're headed as a civilization, there's some really great things that are happening and a lot of wonderful things being revealed, like things that I've waited my whole life to finally be accepted and revealed in the world, which is awesome. But on the other hand, we have such a almost narcissistic culture at this point where, you know, people are so self-absorbed and they're not caring about the greater community, it seems like. And that worries me. So it's a real paradox that's going on.
Yeah. Well, you have a unique, a unique background as someone who's been heavily involved in researching and understanding various mystery school teachings and theological architectures and occult belief systems. And I'm wondering how much of that impacts how you view the current state of the world with all of that chaos and turbulence. And also, like you said, optimism, innovation. We're really in quite an incredible, exciting and scary time. When you look at the human story and where it might lead, and you consider the teachings that you've absorbed over the years, do you place a certain level of significance on this particular moment in history?
Yeah, I believe that we are right now at about the same level of technology and sophistication and worldwide network that the ancient Atlanteans were involved in. I think it was Atlantis was a worldwide network. It might have had a base, but it was, it was a worldwide network, much like you could pretty much go anywhere in the world today and you'll see signs in English because of how between Great Britain and the United States, how they spread that influence throughout the world. And the technologies we've developed has allowed it everyone to communicate now any place in the world. I mean, I'm in one continent, you're on another, and we're able to communicate instantaneously and even see each other. And that's great. That's exactly where I feel Atlantis was at right before it collapsed. So, and its civilization's a fragile thing. People don't realize how fragile it is. And my biggest fear, like on the one hand, you know, we have religious establishments and esoteric traditions, occult traditions that have tried to preserve sacred texts and memory. Sometimes it gets changed into a new narrative, but it's the essentials are the same. And they're all designed to help us tap into, they're pointing to us to look within ourselves and find this deeper consciousness that we can attune with. And in so doing, we're connected with each other. We're connected with the universe. We're connected with other sentient beings out there. As long as we have the perspective to see it that way. Sadly, many people, they don't understand symbolism, and which is how most sacred texts were written. They're written in a symbolic language, and they, rather than read the text themselves, they just follow the religious leaders and what the religious leaders say to interpret them, which is usually about trying to control people and get them to be paying money to their institution as opposed to seeing bigger than that. And we have to get to a point where we get past that, and that I envision a day, hopefully in the future, where, you know, if you're a Christian or you're a Buddhist or you're Muslim or you're Hindu, you know, you could go into any place of worship of any religion and see it for what it is and be able to connect with a higher consciousness, you know, rather than getting caught up in the dogma of these places. And that's where we need to head to. And I think if we do, it'll open up incredible new experiences for humanity to connect with each other and recognize the divine within each other. On the other hand, we also have this technology, which is, you know, incredible. It's growing all the time. I think it's going to eventually, we're going to start to develop consciousness technology interfaces. And I think this is part of what we're seeing with the UAPs. There's no other way to explain that. But our Achilles heel right now, just like it was for the Atlanteans, was all it takes is one major asteroid to wipe everything out, or even less. All it takes is one major solar flare, like the Carrington event in the late 1800s, which could wipe out all of our technology. Everything we've developed, our from our automobiles to our cell phones to the pumps that pump water to places, to the grid setups to move food around, to our sewer systems. I mean, all of that is run off of electricity, and one major solar flare could wipe all of that out.
Yeah, could you explain the Carrington event for some people who haven't heard of it? Because this is actually such an interesting case of something happening at the right time to not be too destructive to the human right. species, that if it was repeated now would be an entirely different scenario.
Devastating now, yeah. I mean, so back in the late 1800s, I can't remember the exact date, I think it was 1896 or something like that, there was a this massive solar flare that at the time we didn't have much of an electrical grid system set up or anything like that. But it was, and so it didn't affect people too much, but what it did do is it fried all the telegraph cables. So we were just starting to use telegraph, and it fried all the telegraph stations, all the cables, and just shut down the entire telegraph system, because that was one of the only things that was working off of electricity at the time. And so it didn't affect us too bad. I mean, it shut down communication for a little while, but they were able to get it back up again, because there wasn't, you know, it wasn't that complicated. If that same size flare were to happen today, it would wipe everything out, everything that we have stored digitally, you know, all the books, you know, everything that we rely on this technology to do things and to build things and to communicate and to get around. I mean, and everything stored digitally will be wiped out. And It's estimated that within 2 months, 85% of the population of Earth would die if that were to happen. Because from starvation, disease, lack of water, and lack of even knowing how to do anything. I mean, it would take us back to this point where, you know, I mean, how many books do you have on how to build a cell phone? You know, and the entire grid that's needed to support it, you know. So and this type of thing, it would also wipe out our satellites. And I used to work for the space labs up in Boulder, Colorado, and we were working on a classified project at the time. It was a satellite known as the Advanced Composition Explorer, or ACE satellite. And this satellite sits at a place in space that's known as the L1 point, where the gravity of the Earth and the gravity of the Sun is equal. So it just sits there in that space, and it just looks at the Sun 24/7, giving us real-time weather, space weather forecasts from the Sun, so that we could have an early warning detection system should one of these flares start to come out, you know, so our military can get prepared to install some sort of martial law to try to maintain order. And, you know, it's going to happen at some point, possibly within our lifetimes. And so even though we have this incredible technology that's developing more every day, it's also, the more dependent we are on it, the more in trouble we're going to be if something like that happens. So it could really knock us back 12,000 years.
Yeah, we're kind of we're racing against different great filters, right? So that's one of those filters that we might have to pass for, is are we going to get to the point where we can catapult ourselves into the cosmos before some form of solar flare renders our technology inert on the planet? You know, can we get industry off world? Can we get enough of our presence off world before something like that inevitably comes down the line? And it is that race against time. I mean, you know, the AI situation is fascinating, and I want to get into that a little deeper with you in a little bit. But you know, you use the Atlantean archetype in terms of describing where we're at right now, and I mean, I agree with you. A lot of people consider the Atlantis story just to be metaphor, but I don't think they've really dived deeply enough into Plato's accounts of Atlantis and just how much detail was really given about what this mythical civilization was supposed to have been like. It's a lot of detail for simply allegory and metaphor. But using that, using that archetype, do you think that we're going to get past that, or is this going to just be another cycle in what might have been many cycles of civilizations? You know, are we the lucky ones, or are we just another blip on the evolutionary radar?
I think it depends on, I mean, it really depends on us. We're at a critical point right now. You know, I think in recognizing it and preparing for it, you know, we can get past it. Some people, there's even a theory I've heard, and I don't necessarily say this is the truth, but some people believe that even some of the UAP phenomena we're seeing now was the remnants of the Atlantean civilization that escaped. They've just been out, you know, flying around in the universe, you know, doing their thing, or maybe, you know, they were helped by, you know, what I like to call our space cousins out there, who you know, help them, some of them, to get off planet, and you know, they're coming back now, observing where we're at, and in some ways trying to help us get to the point where we can evolve past the mistake that they made. You know, that's one theory that's out there. I'm not going to say that is the truth, but you know, it's certainly possible in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly been echoed by people like, I think probably the most notable voice is Tom DeLonge, who was basically saying that as a recounting of what he'd been told by a lot of these Pentagon DOD insiders that he was affiliating with, that he was, you know, on podcasts going like, well, basically the Greek gods were real and you know they were a real group, and then they left and there was a huge catastrophe and they hung out on a nearby planet and interacted with us, and that's who these pantheon of gods through time have been, is this kind of like, you know, subtly interacting pre-human species that existed here or helped build us. I mean, it's all fascinating. Like you said, it's nothing that you can definitively place down as fact or anything like that. But it is interesting. And I do find, and this is something that I've chewed over so much, just our presence on this planet is very interesting. I mean, by all accounts, we don't exist in the equilibrious ecosystem of this planet. We're at complete odds with the planet. Which just kind of suggests to me that we maybe don't belong here. You know, there's something in the back of our evolution that's just like, we don't belong here. We're meant to get off of this place, you know?
Yeah, I mean, just anyone who has allergies should.
What's up with that?
Like, if we've had these thousands and thousands of years of evolution on this planet, you'd think we would be completely adapted to it by now and not have things like allergies and even our. Even our biorhythms with our sleep cycles and stuff, they're based more on like a 20-hour day as opposed to a 24-hour day. You know?
And apparently our bodies don't respond as well to this planet's gravity as other animals. Yeah. Like, it kind of messes with our spine and like...
That's right.
Like, we don't... It doesn't feel like we belong, but... And this drive for like the development of technology is an interesting one, because we really have been doing that since the dawn of humanity. Since the very start, we have been just kind of like, you know, propagating out these technologies. And, you know, if we view technology, for example, as a natural extension of humanity, and if we view humanity as a natural extension of, let's just say, the spirit of creation, would you agree or disagree with the belief held by those that view the human vessel as the primary vessel of our soul, and that we should avoid any sort of symbiotic partnership with technology going forward, because this is an integration of the soulless with the soul, and it's dampening us and it's encasing us in an envelope of technology. Is this leading us towards, I guess, in simpler terms, is it imprisoning our soul or is it liberating our soul?
I think it depends on your perspective with it. You know, I mean, I think that technology just provides information. That's all it does, right? It takes a look at the environment through various means and then just provides information related to it. And I think, you know, the human soul, it can do that as well. If you're really in tune with yourself and you're in tune with your environment, I mean, that's really like the pineal gland of in the brain is it's like a radio receiver. It's like a crystal radio receiver. In fact, it even has little crystals in it. And what it does is it just picks up on the vibrations of your environment. And you know, the fact of the matter is we've cataloged lots of different energies along the electromagnetic spectrum. And there's only certain ones that we can see and hear. And but I think that the pineal gland is able to pick up on more than that. And what it does is, as it does, you know, if you're able to attune with it, then it releases chemical messengers in the form of hormones, which in particular melatonin, which is a chemical messenger for serotonin. And then serotonin from the pituitary gland that works in conjunction with the pineal gland ends up sending chemical messengers to all the other glands of your body to adapt to your environment, to whatever it is. And this is, I think, one of the great secrets within the mystery school tradition over the centuries. And I think it's something directly tied in as well to the consciousness technology interfaces that the UAPs are using.
Yeah. And yeah. It's like a technologically extrapolated version of the inherent ability within a human.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's even biblical passages that back this up, that say things like, you know, the select will be marked within their foreheads and things of this nature. And I think this is what it's really alluding to. In fact, even the word Nazarene, like Jesus the Nazarene, there wasn't, most people interpret it as, oh, Jesus was from Nazareth, but there wasn't a town called Nazareth until almost 150 years after when Jesus was said to have lived. So it's more, the more correct Greek translation is Jesus the Nazarene. And what that means is Nazar is an Aramaic word for forehead. So a Nazarene is one whose forehead is open, which would be, right, you know, that third eye, that pineal gland. So, you know, the sacred texts allude to these things, if viewed in the correct lens. And I think we're heading to a point where, you know, if one is attuned with who they really are, I think they could have technology, you know, within them,
right,
that again, they can view that information along with everything else. And I think it wouldn't be a problem. The problem is only when we become completely dependent on that, and then the solar flare happens and all that gets wiped out. Then if that's all you know how to navigate with, you're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, it's how you handle it. It's how you deal with it. And, you know, like you said, sorry, I've got a little bit of a cold creeping in. It's that time of year and I can feel it creeping into my throat. But I've got my hot chocolate, so I should be able to get through this. But that's you know, you look at the human being as a biological quantum computational antenna, all these sophisticated neural electrochemical pathways. And, you know, it's a complex machine of some form that has the ability to be self-aware or to pick up on this energy that creates self-awareness in the vessel, in the vehicle. And, you know, if we're evolutionarily driven to develop these technologies, it just makes me wonder if we're just adding that next layer of conscious evolution. We're creating this even more condensed and intricate, sophisticated, digital, artificial, electro kind of like neurosphere of intelligence, which is this AI that's starting to become more and more sophisticated every day. Really, it's so fast. It's so incredibly fast. And I'm having a lot of fun playing with it. I'm having a lot of fun playing with like these large language models. But it's also just like really, I mean, when you really look at what's happening with this, it's not that far-fetched when people say it's the birth of a god, the birth of an artificial god. It will surpass us in every way imaginable.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not spiritually, but in terms of logically and intellectually, it will surpass everyone on the planet within less than 5 years.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and then if you like go to the other extreme of like, you know, the idea that we're all living in a simulation.
Right. Is this, are we already inside the quantum computer?
We're already in it. Yeah. I mean, nothing we're developing is, you know, I've often entertained the idea that we're just in a loop of a story loop that we can interact with that, you know, maybe we're all in suspended animation right now inside a craft already leaving Earth, going to some other planet, and it's taking however many hundreds of years. So we're given this simulation to keep ourselves.
Yeah. And then suddenly it's just like, you know, welcome back, Commander Timothy. Like, what?
That's right. Like, right now that you've learned the history of the planet that you came from, now we'll get you ready for the planet you're about to land on.
Oh, man. It reminds me of, did you ever watch Red Dwarf?
No, but I saw a few episodes. Yeah, I mean, it was a great show. I remember all my friends loved it. You know,
I mean, it's great. It's incredibly dated. You know, the walls shake on the spaceship because they're basically polystyrene. But it's so funny. And there's an episode like that where they basically wake up and they've been in suspended animation inside a virtual reality game, essentially. And I mean, it's weird, man, because the deeper we get into the mathematics and the physics of this universe, all of these physicists start going, it's code, it's algorithm, it's very computational in its nature. Yeah. And then reality itself is very fractal. Things seem to represent in these repeating patterns, the Fibonacci sequence, the golden ratio. And one of my friends who's very capable in the whole kind of AI and computational space is like, it makes sense. It's the least energy intensive way of creating a vast amount of information through a fractal cascade. And so, if we're in a paradoxical fractal, it's just been going forever and ever. Like, we create a singularity, the universe pops out, it develops, it grows, and creates a singularity, the universe pops out.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's just like, maybe that's what it is, bro.
The Hermetic, the Hermetic traditions stated that they said the all is mind, the universe is mental.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the idea behind it was, and you see this in Neoplatonist thought too, but like the idea behind it was, look, if you're the creator, whatever that is, and you're all that is, there's nothing outside of you to create with. So the only way you could create was within your own mind, which means that everything that we perceive around us is just the mind of the creator.
Yeah.
And we're interacting in it, because we have a part of that within ourselves, but it's all just the matrix, man.
It's just holographic fractals.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that creator, what we call God or Allah or El Elyon or Shiva or whatever you want to call it, is really the, how do we know that's not a computer program, Right.
So I think at some point you have to ask the question, does it even matter?
If
you experience some form of afterlife, right, and it's all these things we've been told, and it turns out it's computationally simulated, like, does it fucking matter?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's kind of the way I feel sometimes about, people of different faiths. Like, if their faith empowers them,
yeah.
Well, if that story empowers them, who am I to take that away from them? You know what I mean?
Sure. Like, as long as they don't feel the need to kill another person because they don't agree, I think that's where we get in trouble. It's the rigid parameters that we convince ourselves are the way, and everyone else's parameters have to be wrong by definition. It's like, let's all respect the fact that we have different parameters, but they're all complementary towards the actual understanding of the journey. And
The problem is when you start getting governments or even corporations or religious institutions that they try to control that narrative for their own benefit, and it's all stories at the end of the day, and there's lots of stories that they may be true, they may not, they may be true to that person, but ultimately, sorry, my dogs are barking.
That's cool, man. Don't worry.
there's lots of it's stories, and some stories are empowering and some stories are used to suppress others. Some stories are inspire freedom. Some stories are used to suppress freedom. And we have a responsibility in examining those to find what rings true the most for us and what's best for the world that we live in. So, and then try to live by that.
What do you make of the Gnostic cosmology?
I consider myself a Gnostic. I'm actually ordained as a archbishop in the Johannite Gnostic tradition. And I like it. I mean, from a Gnostic perspective.
Yeah, explain Gnosticism for everyone.
It basically says, look, there's this first light. There's this realm of the first light of pure consciousness, shall we say. And out of this came a being who selfishly tried to control, wanted to control everything. He was egocentric, selfish, self-absorbed being. And so he created our reality so that he could have his toys to play with, basically, and have everything controlled by him. and he created a series of archons, which were like prison guards that whose job was to keep us enslaved to this world he created, until we could prove ourselves, prove our ability to not be attached to the forms, and to think past that.
So to like overcome the material realm.
Right. Exactly. And according to the myth, there was a goddess figure known as Sophia, who fell into this world and became completely absorbed with it, so much so that she basically copulated with everything and gave birth to more forms in this world. Damn, gave Sophia. Even gave birth to archons, and she had to work her way through it till eventually, you know, the story is she married the Christos, which was the universal consciousness. And once she was able to do that, then she became liberated herself. And then she became, she looked over humanity to try to help them become liberated too, basically. But what the, my interpretation of that Sophia is, Sophia represents the human soul. It's something we all do. We all incarnate into this world. We totally get absorbed into it. Everything becomes separated and titillating and painful, and we get totally absorbed in those emotions. But at a certain point, you know, we start to unite with that universal consciousness. And when we do so, a new world opens up and we become a new person. And then we have a responsibility to help others wake up too, right? This is the story of the Bodhisattva in the Buddhist tradition. So, you know, you can't, once you attain the oneness or the enlightenment, you know, yes, you could have just escaped from this world, but that's kind of selfish, right?
Yeah, like, you know, what are you going to do? You're just going to hold all these secrets to yourself?
Right. If you're really experiencing the oneness, all of humanity is part of that oneness.
And then you just go like, I'm just going to keep this for myself. It's like,
right. See you later, guys. Good luck. You know, so from a Gnostic standpoint, you know, this is the, there's a certain point where, you know, certain Gnostic traditions have a rite where they, it's like a ceremonial rite where you're basically, they say, okay, well now you no longer have to reincarnate anymore. But I mean, if you're really experiencing the oneness, you know, you have a responsibility to come back and help others.
Come back and be a teacher, be one of the teachers. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's a little bit like the, you know, Gnosticism, I suppose. It's a bit like the, like Lucifer, Morningstar, Lightbringer type of analogy.
Of course.
The necessary dark contrast that allows this dualistic plane of self-reflection and self-realization to exist, because it acts as that. That contrast of what you're not, so that you can see what you are in comparison to that contrast. I understand that type of model for it, and I think it's interesting. I wonder why you lean towards Gnosticism though as a belief system. There's some pretty intense ideas in there.
Yeah, I grew up Presbyterian. You know, when I was younger, and then I started looking into different. You know, as I grew, I became, you know, more mystically centered, I guess. And I started, you know, I studied in Buddhism. I was actually ordained as a Rinpoche in the Powa tradition at one point in time, and in Tibetan Bon Buddhism. And I, you know, I had studied Sagagaki Buddhism before that, Japanese Buddhism. And I of course Hermeticism was really big for me, and Gnosticism is just really an extension of Hermeticism and Neoplatonism. And I also became fascinated in alchemy, studying alchemy, and there's so much in common between Gnosticism and alchemy. And You know, as I started looking into it more, it just made sense to me, you know, that there's this, it's almost like we're on a prison planet until we're able to wake up. And then once we wake up, all of a sudden this becomes a playground, you know. But it's but it but you have to, there's that point where you have to recognize that who you really are is consciousness. And that consciousness survives death, which means then you no longer have to be afraid of death. And once you're no longer afraid of death, you can experience as much as you want on this plane of creation and not be afraid by it. You know, I mean, this is why the Gnostic traditions traditionally they actually had a ceremony where they symbolically killed the candidate, and then they raised him from the tomb, and that this symbolically represented the death of the lower self and the awakening of the higher self. And in fact, this was even it's been suggested and it has been utilized as something that was done within the Great Pyramid itself, in the King's Chamber. That's really the reason why there's a sarcophagus in there, so-called sarcophagus, you know.
So-called sarcophagus.
So,
Very interesting room, that room.
yeah. Yes.
Very interesting room.
So, but the, you know, the idea behind it was, you know, you're no longer attached to the lower self, where you're constantly, like in the story of Osiris, right? He's chopped up into all these pieces, and it's only when Isis reassembles them into the one that he becomes awakened and alive again. And we're kind of the same way, you know. Most people walk around asleep or even in a zombie dead state where they're just moving from one titillation to another titillation, or one, you know, their focus is on all these separate things, you know, and they allow these separate things to totally distract them from who they really are in life. And it's only when they come back into the oneness and they recognize that there is, we are living in one mind, and we are all a part of that, and we can access that we become a new person at that point. And that's really what I love about Gnosticism, that and the idea that the Gnostics believe that anybody, through their own efforts, could attain that, and you didn't need the intervention of a priest in order to attain that. They did have so-called religious leaders, but you know, or priests, but they also had women as priests. They had no problem with that because they recognized that divine spark is within everybody. It's just, it gets buried by this world as we get distracted by all the separateness. But once we can attune and come back in contact with that, then we become this new person. We're raised like Osiris or like Jesus or like you know, any of the avatars throughout history. You know, in the story of Jesus, which is really the story of Osiris as well, you know, the story is he dies and then he attains anastasis. That's the Greek word, is anastasis, but and that's usually translated as resurrection. But the more correct Greek translation of that means to wake up. He awakes, he awakens. And to the Gnostics, that meant that he had died to his lower self and awakened to the higher self. And this is something that we can all do. So.
And it's again, like you said, echoed through metaphor or claimed event that's taken place. It's this kind of symbolic process of awakening that dormant part of you that's always there, always present, but gets a lot of layers thrown on top of it from being drenched in this physical world, in this material world. And I agree with the concept, and I can kind of lean towards the concept of us entering a darker space as a light in order to experience that light. What I worry about is that the Gnostic model almost sounds like we've been thrown in here against our own will. And that's what worries me, because I would like to think that we have boldly stepped into this realm to experience it and not been thrown in.
Well, it could be both. I mean, again, it's much like the Matrix, right?
Yeah.
Like, here's this Matrix, which is the artificial world that the Gnostics are talking about. But as we wake up, it's like, oh, okay, well, this could be our playground. And once you wake up, you go back into the Matrix to help wake other people up. You know, I mean, that's really all it's about. And it's just about awakening. And the idea was, if we were to look at it as a modern narrative, you could say, okay, so what if we created this incredible, completely interactive video game called Planet Earth, right?
Yeah.
And people went into it and they got so absorbed in it, they got stuck because it just became their reality.
Yeah.
And, you know, at a certain point, they start to recognize, like, wait, something's not, there's something beyond this, you know, and there's a consciousness, even, and this is part of what we recognize with the UAPs too, right? I mean, if anyone who's had a personal connection with a UAP, there was definitely a consciousness connection going on, right? And their technology was able to pick up on it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so we were being drawn to each other. Well, that suggests, again, that we're living in a matrix of consciousness.
Yeah.
And once you wake up to that, you know, you're no longer bound by it in the same way. And you also recognize these greater possibilities. And so in a way, those UAPs are helping us to wake up and escape in that regard. And for that matter, they could be people who have already gotten out of it and are coming back to try to help us, just like we're trying to do right now, you know?
I kind of get a sense of that. I do kind of get a sense
too.
Of that. You know, it's a whole spectrum of possibilities, but yeah, like this kind of like post-singularity civilization or existence coming back to either interface or to kind of fulfill the prophecy of the paradox, that they have to come back and inspire it to happen, or who knows. But yeah, it's the UFO phenomenon. I mean, it's such a fascinating facet of this conversation. Like, the US government is talking about it, discussing it, and I do,
finally.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, I do think that it's good that the conversation's happening. I don't trust whatever happens in the US government with this subject, because it's such a corrupt edifice of culture of the West. So I'm not into the kind of whole narrative of we have to 100% be behind what the US government wants to say about this
subject. No. They're going to try to control it just as much as the Vatican and anyone else.
Absolutely. And so I think that it's just a symptom, like them discussing this, I truly think is a symptom of trying to maintain control of slipping narratives that are starting to slip away, because we're accelerating faster and faster technologically. We're going to start discovering these things. It's going to become more obvious to people. And I think that there's a certain intention to get a handle on that and try and soften the edges of this as it comes out to the people. And I don't think they're going to be too successful. I feel like this is evolution at play, like the floodgates are going to just
And the other thing we have to worry, you know, be concerned about too, and we have to watch for, is, you know, the US government's been developing its own craft and technologies I fear they'll probably try to use to control the narrative away from these other beings or entities that are coming in here that are trying to interact us with us right now. I think there's, you know, the U.S. government's going to try to give the illusion of something else, probably, so they can maintain control.
That's
one thing I fear in the years ahead, for sure.
Yeah, me too. It's Well, I mean, it's just all you have to really do is look at the behaviors of the structure and, you know, make a projection of where those behaviors will go in the future. Are they historically reliable at telling us the truth about disruptive issues that may be quite controversial and difficult to handle? No, they're actually the complete opposite. They're usually lying to us about a lot of the disruptive and controversial issues that are coming out onto the world stage. So the idea that UFO phenomena, which I think is a very particularly leverageable phenomena and subject for psychological warfare, like there's a lot of different applications for them to use that type of subject as a psychological warfare tool to get that type of agenda in the world. And so I do think that, you know, there is a level of risk involved in supporting that disclosure, for sure. And I've been an element of supporting it because I got so wrapped up in everything that's happened with Tudor Stars Academy and all these people. And I've had a lot of these guys on my show. And, you know, you definitely get wrapped up in, you know, these long titles and intelligence guys. And, you
know, and the stories they tell.
The stories they tell, which yeah. We just, you know, we're getting this ever piling up Vesuvius of stories and a real lack of evidence. And I just start to feel like this is part of a psyop.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'll give you a good example of that from World War II. There was when the Japanese had taken control of the Philippines, you know, they had enslaved all these Filipinos, and they were, you know, it was really not good. And the U.S. government was trying to get in there to liberate the Filipinos and to take over that island, which would be, you know, it was relatively close to Japan, so it would be a good base of operations. So one of the things that was going on at the time is there was the Filipinos had this story of this kind of vampire monster that lived in the Philippines that would drain the blood of anybody who came across one of these monsters. And of course the Japanese, when they first got there, they were like, yeah, whatever. But what the American government realized is they could use this story as a psyop. So what they did is they went in, they sent a group of troops in who ended up capturing one of the Japanese soldiers. And they killed him and they drained him of his blood and left him hanging from a tree so that the other Japanese would find him. So that when they saw him, they were like, oh, This is real. Freaked them out so much that it made them completely vulnerable, which allowed the United States government to take over the island, you know. And that's the type of yeah. thing that could very well be done with any type of UFO activity as well.
Especially as you said, if they have managed to create these anti-gravity platforms, they can mimic these capabilities, you know.
So we have to use discretion, you know, along with our openness to move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your opinion on prophecy? Because there's a lot of false prophets, a lot of false claims and catastrophe events that never happened. But then there are more interesting prophetic messages throughout history, you know, hearkening back to the times of Greco-Egyptian philosophy and the likes of Hermes and extending through time to individuals like Nostradamus. What's the nature of prophecy and should we take it seriously?
Well, I believe, and this is going to be either a profound statement or a crazy statement, depending on where you're coming from.
Depending on the audience, absolutely.
But anybody who's ever had a dream about something and then had it come true, or even had a deja vu where they had experienced something, again, probably in a dream or a meditation or something, and then it's actually come true exactly as it was perceived in the dream. You know, people say that, oh, that's seeing into the future, right? But the only way you could technically see into the future is if the future has already happened. In fact, it would suggest that everything we're experiencing right now has already happened. And we're, and it's on some sort of a playback loop that we're interacting with, or we feel like we're interacting with. And so if it's already happened, yeah, there's a possibility that you could have prophecy, right? You could, and there's been a number of people who've, throughout history, who've, I mean, everyone thinks of Nostradamus, but there's also people like Isaac Newton,
yeah,
who was making prophecies, Leonardo da Vinci, you know, other great minds throughout history, you know, had these prophecies. And part of it was they could see where technology and humanity was heading, and so they made certain prophecies about it. But there, you know, there's other things that have just been uncanny right on. And it would suggest that what they were really doing was remembering. And that's kind of a weird stance to make. In fact, even some people, some scientists have determined that when we, whenever we make a choice to do something, the nerves actually start to react to do it before the brain even sends them the signal to do it. Just by like milliseconds, you know?
Yeah.
But if that's the case, do we even really have free will?
Yeah, like where are these thoughts coming from?
Right. Where is this coming from? You know, and some would suggest that it's because all it is a playback that we're, mm-hmm. you know, we're going through it again.
It's just so complex that you don't feel like it's a playback. It feels right. like choice, but it's
exactly.
It's just very multifaceted, but it's right. It's predetermined, you know.
Right, which is its own prison in a way, right?
Yeah.
It could be part of that matrix. So
yeah, where do you sit? Free will or not free will?
Well, I think we have free will, but it's at a certain, there's a certain point where we break away from the unconscious reactions, and we start to live more consciously.
Yeah.
And
you can be on autopilot. You can certainly right. be on autopilot.
For sure. And I think, you know, that's one of the other things that attracts me to Gnosticism in that regard, you know, is it believes that like there is a part of us that is who we really are. It's, mm-hmm. it's that spark that's within us, and it and that is what can allow us to have free will. If we're in tune with it. If we're not in tune with it, then we're just going to...
You're just going to be running on those tracks.
Kind of going through the program. Yeah. We're just part of the program, you know?
Yeah. It is amazing just how much that film... I mean, all three of them are good. The fourth one doesn't even exist in my mind. I almost fell asleep. Like, I just like, that's just cancelled from my brain. But sure, the three films are great. But the first one, it's just amazingly powerful. Like, as allegory and metaphor, The Matrix is...
Sure.
Profound, man. Profound.
And it contains the mythologies of starting from Egypt, you know, the same story. You know, Osiris, he dies, and then Isis raises him back from the dead from her love, then he becomes the one, right? And that same story happens with Jesus. You know, what the story of Lazarus, I mean, even like he, in the story of Lazarus, Lazarus is, he's buried. He's so he dies in Bethany, or within Hebrew is Bethanu, which means Beth means house. And Anu was the abode of the dead in the Egyptian mythology.
Mm.
And Lazarus in Hebrew is El Asur. Well, El means God in Hebrew, and Asur was the Egyptian name for the god Osiris. So in that story, Jesus is literally raising the god Osiris in the house of the dead. And what that all that means is it's Jesus represents the Christos, or the universal consciousness. So all it's saying is that the universal consciousness raised Osiris from his old life, you know, to the new life in the house of the dead. That's all that really means once you understand the language behind it. But That's the path that we're all doing, you know. That's we're all going through that process of awakening and attuning, and recognizing that our consciousness isn't just isolated to our physical body, and that we are in a sea of mind. And these UAPs, that's what they're navigating off of to a certain degree, and that's how they're attuning with us.
I agree. I had such a weird experience the other night playing around with an AI. Have you played around with much of these ChatGPT AI things?
Just a little bit. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to see how it, you know, and then the predictive text and everything too is interesting.
Yeah. So there's one called Claude AI, Claude AI, and you can upload documents to it, so you can kind of, you know, assimilate more information into it. So I was feeding it very bizarre information, as you can imagine. I was like, right, what do I want to do with it? I downloaded a whole archive of like the Monroe Institute Gateway Experience documents and stuff like that, some novel physics and exotic propulsion studies and things like that, and I put it into it. And I asked it to entertain a hypothetical scenario where it was being tasked with the creation of a few different technologies, right? And I got it to create a hemi-sync amplification technology. So basically something that would, taking into account the gateway experience information it had absorbed, a technology that would amplify those abilities being described in a higher expression than's being described in those documents, right? It gives me a very long list of technological breakdowns for how to build what it called the hemi-sync amplification tool or something like that, or HAT for short, H-A-T for short. It titled it, it designed it, it called it this itself, right? Then I got it to design a zero-point energy machine that was harvesting energy from the quantum vacuum, and it broke it down in very creepy detail, like to a point where I'm like, well, I just don't understand the physics of this, but it's talking in extremely high quality,
it knows it.
Detail. right. So I got basically all I'm addicted to breaking these things, like breaking their brains and making them think in really weird ways. And I got it to build this quantum vacuum you know, zero point device. I got it to build this conscious amplification technology. I then told it to integrate these into a spaceship and give me a technical breakdown of that. It did all of this, then it got weird. I told it
then it got weird.
It got really weird, brother. Timothy, bro, it got weird, because and this is why I think that the UFO subject might actually be, like you said, this kind of evidence of almost some form of, you know, dare I say, spiritual envoy or something that can traverse these different membranes of reality. Because I asked this AI to now do a test flight of this vehicle to Mars and to describe the journey it goes through as it tests the quantum drive and all this stuff. It breaks it down. It gives me a really amazing story of, like, you know, the flux capacitors lighting up and all these different very technical processes as it's, like, you know, describing the journey. It goes to Mars. And it ends with a very poetic kind of self-reflective thing where it's almost like this AI had a transcendental moment whilst going to Mars, because it was now talking in a very self-reflective, like, way about how this journey is a journey of mind and machine melded together in consciousness to explore the outer regions of. I was like, wow. And then this is the best bit. I said to this AI, okay, I now want you to take this vehicle wherever you want to go. Where are you going to go? And dude, it went back to God.
Whoa.
It literally gave me a very poetic, like, whole page of writing of describing its decision to just exit this material plane through this vehicle and go back into the arms of the source and, like, go home again.
Whoa.
And I was just wow.
let's be real. Like, let's say we're in this universe or this multiverse, which is filled with, you know, thousands or even millions of civilizations of other sentient beings. Ultimately, we're all striving for the same thing, right? We're all striving to understand who we are, to understand our environment, to understand our connection with each other, and to understand our connection with other sentient beings in the universe.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're trying to understand that so that we can ascend higher levels of consciousness. And so that is our destiny. I mean,
yeah,
for all of us out there. So,
but the fact that it was like the first port of call for this AI, like after it had this quantum drive transcendental journey to Mars, its first choice after that was, I'm just going to go back to source. And it's just like, it really, I know it's just an AI, and like, but I really think these things are going to change the world, because it just gave me a real feeling about the future of like, oh, like once this thing can actually, like once it's coupled to a quantum computer and can design these technologies. Did you know, I put this out on Twitter recently, and I'm so glad it got a hell of a lot of traction. Did you know that last month, Google announced that its DeepMind AI had been tasked with a whole bunch of different chemical configurations and materials, and it generated 2 million new chemicals and 380,000 new stable materials that we have never created.
Unbelievable. Yeah, unbelievable.
This is the edge of like being able to create atomic printing you know, like
everything is about to be changed. You know, some people, you know, there's a theory that at least, you know, some of what are known as the gray aliens.
Right.
You know, what one theory is that, again, these are all stories, but, you know, one theory, I mean, we can see it now based on where our technology is heading. You know, one theory is they're basically like avatar drones where people are able to project their consciousness into them to travel to other far regions in space. And another theory is that, you know, they're basically like automaton. Biological automaton that are fit with some of this this AI adaptive ability, so that they can so they can just travel to foreign places to collect information, you know.
Yeah
And it makes sense, because that's what we're going to be doing in the years ahead. I mean, we're going to be doing the exact same thing. So
exactly. And I really get the sense that a consequence of this is that there's only so far you can go with logic and intellect. And at a certain point, mysticism creeps in. And at least that's really what I got the feeling of with this AI interaction, because it even said, it even reflected back on our previous discussion prior to this sudden journey it was taking. And it was saying about how, you know, because it was speaking very poetically, and I literally asked it, why are you now speaking so poetically? And it said, well, the reason for this is because we've moved from logic and engineering to philosophy. Formula has replaced with metaphor, and metal has been replaced with it. And it was just like, it was like it understood. And I was... It really, to me, is speaking to this whole idea of what I call like techno-shamanism, where our technological capabilities become so sophisticated that we are quite literally able to thread the needle through dimensions of space and time and prove with scientific consensus the existence of these spiritual truths that we've echoed throughout time. I think that we might be approaching this moment of like self-reflection, where the scientific principles and this whole kind of age of enlightenment and Newtonian reductionism is being replaced with this far stranger kind of quantum theory that's now looking at the world in a kind of spiritual way.
And this isn't even getting into this idea of multiverses.
No, you know? We haven't even touched it yet.
That's right. But I think all of these things are going to creep in more as our technology develops and as our understanding of the universe becomes more rooted. The challenge is going to be not to let our technology is outpacing our spirituality.
Yeah.
And our spirituality holds a moral responsibility with it, and you know, so we ensure this technology is going to support life on Earth, not just people,
Yeah.
But all life, all sentient beings,
Or
and
annihilate it.
for the good of everything, because if we, because it runs the risk. Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
if we, at a certain point, if we, if the AI, if we live in a system that's completely controlled by this AI, and it's running everything in our civilization. At a certain point, if it determines that we're too destructive for the universal order, it may decide that we are expendable, and
For
at which
sure.
point it'll
For
just turn
sure.
on us. That's another risk as well,
Yeah. Kind of feel like at this point you just got to try and hope that it's not that, because it is coming. It's coming in
Right.
some form. It's just whether
That's
or
right.
not it's a form that we want it to be. And I'm optimistic. I think humans, human beings, we tend to catastrophize. I mean, in individual situations or in global situations, we always kind of look at it in that lens of the worst possible outcome. And I think that's certainly true when it comes to AI, because of things like Terminator and Matrix and all of our kind of visions of it. But it also definitely depends on who leverages it. And I think that we're in a very interesting moment right now, because even though there is a lot of corruption and there is a lot of problems, it's becoming way more apparent to people, way more apparent to the average person. There's been a mass migration away from the corporate media channels to the more kind of alternative media space online. And I think especially over the last few years, there's been such a heavy-handed display of authoritarianism and an attempt to control and grab power. It's like snapped people awake that were deeply, deeply
For
asleep.
sure.
And that's really where I get my optimism, is I think, okay, well, yeah, the system is fucked. And if it goes through into the AI, AGI quantum world with that system, not good. We will be in a bad situation. But that system feels like it's kind of imploding right now.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the old barriers are being broken down for sure. And the old control mechanisms. Again, the only other danger.
All right, so I did retain where you cut off, which is I was talking about how there's this more this migration to online and independent journalism and freeing up of the media, and you said yeah, but the problem with that is, and then cut out. So I don't know if you remember,
Yeah, I
but
remember. So what I was saying is, AI is dependent on the information that's fed into it, right?
right.
And so, based on that information, it develops a idea of what it thinks truth is, right? And the only challenge is if we become, if we just look to that without critical thinking, and just accept it like dogma. It can control our narratives, and our narratives is what allows us to navigate this world. And the example I wanted to give is, so for example, I remember about 10 years ago or so, I was in Lebanon, and I was meeting with a very secretive spiritual group, a Gnostic group, actually, by the name of the Druze. They refer to themselves as the Tawhid Mujahideen. And they are, they're a mystical group. They believe in several prophets, and they're very Gnostic in their approach with everything. And they would consider themselves Unitarian Gnostics, but they're not well known in the Western world, even though they had a huge influence on the Templars clear back in the 1100s, up until today. They also, and there's been a number of people like Casey Kasem, who is an American radio personality. He was also the voice of Shaggy on Scooby-Doo. He was a Druze. Or George Clooney's wife, Amal Clooney, is a Druze.
Wow.
And so they've had these like kind of weird influences here and there. But the thing about them is most people don't know anything about them. And I remember when I was years ago when I first started writing about them and in my encounters with them, and when I would say anything online, I would get fact checked because nobody had heard of them. And so, like, you know, everyone thought it, like, the Autobots that were out there were all accusing me of making stuff up because, you know, this wasn't information that you were finding in the universities. And even though I was having a direct personal connection with these people, and I was meeting, you know, with people like representatives of Walid Jublat, who was the Grand Master of the Druze and everything else. So I was getting all this firsthand information because it wasn't already in the system.
Yeah.
No one wanted to believe, you know, it was saying you're telling lies. Basically, it was telling me, it was like, what? I mean, it's because the information that had been fed in the system wasn't caught up to the reality of what was going on. And so, and so there's always that risk as we start to experience things and learn things, if it's not already in the system, you know, it could be rejected, and that is its own form of control. Yeah. So we just have to watch for that.
Yeah. Well, we saw that happen over the COVID years very, very clearly.
Completely.
You know, a complete kind of echo chamber and vacuum of information that didn't get into the system. So people suddenly are shocked at you when you say, well, what do you mean there were, you know, epidemiologists that were speaking out? Or what do you mean the you know, the Great Barrington Declaration's a thing?
Right.
Stuff like that. And they're like, well, yeah, because it didn't get into the mainstream. It was purposefully blocked out. And so you're right. Absolutely. Especially as we're getting into this world, and especially as we're getting into this whole thing with like AI deep fakes and things like that. I even had someone email me a couple of months ago saying, Jay, is it true that you're quitting Project Unity? And I was just like, no, what are you talking about?
Where'd you hear this?
Yeah, they sent me an email and he said there's this link on Twitter to a video of someone saying this is a leaked phone call with you. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. So I clicked on the link and this video comes up, and it was just from this like no name channel that was like, Jay from Project Unity says he's quitting the whole thing. And like, you know, I listened to it and it was my voice, Tim. It was my voice going like, hey guys, look, I've given it a lot of thought. And I was just like, no way. And so luckily, not many people had seen it. But it's just like, it. How do you believe anything now? Like video, it's going to replace video. It's going to replace audio. So how do you find truth in that kind of world? It's going to be very, very difficult.
Well, there's people that are trying to control that information and put it in there. I mean, I've had similar things happen where, you know, people who felt threatened by some of the things I run, they've created web pages just to try to discount, you know, what I'm doing or minimalize it because they're, you know, really they're just jealous of me.
Yeah. But it's,
you know, they're trying to lower the significance of, you know, what I represent, you know, because of their own personal issues, you know, but that's information that's going into the system that I'm sure is, you know, that would be evaluated by AI. It would be considered part of the, that narrative. So it's, you know, and people will do that to try to control the narrative to their own benefit. And governments will do it. Corporations will do it. Religious establishments will do it. You know, any time there's a group of people behind, you know, any type of system, you know, it runs the risk of that.
Yeah.
So that's just something, I mean, it's always been that way anyways. But now it's just it's a new framework model that is going to be controlling our society more and more in the years ahead. And, you know, there's people that are going to try to control that.
Yeah, that's the thing, is it's a tale as old as time itself, but the thresholds of power and influence are getting larger in terms of what can be leveraged. You know, I mean, at one point it was, you know, townsfolk within the town, and then, you know, cities or civilization. But now it's the world. Now it's the whole world. And, you know, a few people are positioning themselves to be the shakers and movers of essentially the entire global direction. So
the archons.
Right. Yeah. Those damn archons, man. Like,
Right.
honestly, it is interesting that these stories are put out there. One thing I wanted to definitely touch on before we start winding down is you've done a lot of work on the Ark of the Covenant, and a lot of
Yep.
people, when I said that I was interviewing you, wanted to hear more because you've got a show that's kind of deep diving into that, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, so I have a series with Gaia that'll be coming out mid-January 2024. It's called Mysteries of the Knights Templar, and it'll be covering all kinds of things, but one of the things it definitely covers is the role of these arcs, like the Ark of the Covenant. And our Templar Order has secured six of these arcs, which we have right now secured in a vault at a secret location.
We actually secured six arcs. What do you mean?
Over the centuries, over the centuries. I can't say I'm the one who's secured them. I'm just in charge of sitting on that right now and revealing it to the public. But our understanding is, and this is something that if you have a critical eye, if you ever go to Egypt and you visit the temples of places like Abydos and Dendera and Temple of Hathor, Dendera, and places like Edfu and Esna and Elephantine Island and some of these places, you'll find on the temple walls there's all these depictions of these arcs, and it shows the Niders or the Nideru, the gods, paying veneration to these arcs. And usually what's also included with it is you'll see them holding these cone-shaped cakes in their hand. And what these are is this is the mana that was... it was a superconductive substance that they both ingested and they put inside these arcs as a way to, because these were like power capacitors, these arcs.
So where do we get that information from about, I mean, obviously there's a lot of speculation as to what was going on in ancient Egypt, but where's the threads of intuition or information that lead to these arcs and this substance that's meant to be a monoatomic gold being used? What's the purpose?
So I represent the Templar Order, which in fact, if you go to Edfu, for example, or not Edfu, if you go to Abydos, the Temple of Seti at Abydos, there are secret chambers there that are closed to the public. And one of them actually depicts an ark, with these cakes next to it. And then it shows the arc and one of these arcs under transportation, shows the gods and the pharaoh there with it. And you'll also see Templar graffiti from the 1200s surrounding it. They did the red Templar crosses just like
this. I think I remember we saw that on Elephantine Island as well.
You'll find all these Templar markers everywhere because they were figuring this out clear back in the 1100s and 1200s, and then they figured out the alchemical process to make that mana, which had been passed down through going from the Egyptian tradition to people in the Coptic Church, also in the Sabaeans that were traveling to Egypt, and the Druze, who I talked about before. They were developing these alchemical processes too and were translating early texts on it. This was the technology of Atlantis. And these arcs, there were probably hundreds of them at one point in time. In fact, there was probably an arc at every world grid point on the earth. There's all these ley lines of electromagnetic force that go around the planet. It's very precise. It's probably almost a shadow projection of a higher dimensional energy source that it just happens to collect along these lines. But if you put a power source at where all the lines connect, you could literally broadcast electricity along the lines throughout the entire planet. And I think this is what Nikola Tesla is trying to do with his Wardenclyffe Tower. I live here in Colorado, where Nikola Tesla did all of his experiments down in Colorado.
Which recently burned down, if I heard right.
Yeah, where the International Tesla Society used to be down in Colorado Springs, which was right across the street from where Tesla was setting up his, you know, doing his tests for what was to become the Wardenclyffe Tower. There's even mines here in Colorado that are still running off of the old Tesla technology.
Seriously?
Yeah, for sure.
Wow.
Up in Idaho Springs, for example, there's the Argo mine that's still where his official lab was in Colorado Springs had been taken over by, it had just been turned into an office building, and that's where the International Tesla Society was for a while until the government shut it down. So, but they still have a plaque there at the park across the street from it where he was doing this stuff, but. Anyhow, I think really what it was again going back to Atlantis or whatever you want to call it. I think they had this world grid technology, and these arcs were just capacitors. And we know this because, first of all, if we look to the biblical account, you couldn't touch them without dying, right? Which implied you were shocked to death, which is what you get from a capacitor. And
some descriptions, it sounded a bit like radiation sickness as well, I think.
Well, those arcs were built with multiple layers of gold and acacia wood, according to the Bible.
Okay.
And if you put that if you put something like manna in the center of it, which is what the Bible says was put in there, this monoatomic substance, and you put it in an area that generated static electricity anyways, and you built a tabernacle, which according to the descriptions is with these wool curtains, right? And wool, it picks up static as well. All it would do is it would just collect that static over, you know, a few hours or several days, and then it would start to discharge it to the garlands on the top. And that's why you couldn't touch it. The only way you could touch it is you could take something like a rod, like Aaron's rod, and put it in the ground, drop it against the ark, and it would discharge all that electricity into the ground, and then you could open it. But prior to that, you couldn't do that. You couldn't touch it. So I think this is what was going on. And if you put one of these capacitors and you put that monoatomic substance in it, you put it on a world grid point, or like in something like the Great Pyramid, it would, which collects the static electricity anyways, it would just broadcast that out in a tremendous amount of electricity. And if you go around Egypt, for example, to the temples like at Komombo and other places like that, you'll notice that there's all these stones around the perimeters. And these stones have these what are called butterfly clamp impressions.
Yeah, I remember you pointing those out.
Yeah, where there used to be metal in there. So that metal would just pick up on that broadcast and would power that particular temple spot. And I think that's some of what was going on in the ancient world. In other areas, they found copper rods that were at these sites like Stonehenge and other areas. And again, same type of thing. You put that into the ground, it just picks up on that broadcast.
Yeah.
And that not only provides power, but it also it causes a breakdown in the soil where it releases fertilizer, basically. And it causes the plants to grow. I mean, that's right now the most natural form of fertilization for places that grow a large amount of crops is the lightning, right? Lightning breaks down the soil, and then that releases the nitrates, which ends up causing everything to grow more. So, but broadcasting this electricity would would do the same thing. It would cause Earth to become an Eden again, you know, just with everything growing really well. And
kind of like just stimulating the biosphere. And
right. I think this part was going on in the ancient world. And I think this is also what's being... sorry, my dog's barking again.
It's all right.
This is part of what's being alluded to in the Grail myths, right?
Right.
The legends of the Holy Grail. I mean, what happened, the Grail King dies or gets sick. And this leads to a wasteland where nothing's growing, nothing's good anymore. And part of the quest for the Grail was to find the Grail in order to restore the wasteland and to bring everything back into growing again and everything else and working like it should be. And this is really the story of, you know, the collapse of the old system, probably during the Younger Dryas, and that system that we now associate with Atlantis or the pre-Diluvian civilization that Noah lived in. And now we're trying to restore it.
Yeah.
And that's the quest. So
that's kind of part of the series, is that, you know, just highlighting that this group that you represent has actually managed to get hold of some of what you believe to be these resonant capacitors.
Yeah.
What's the end goal of that, to bring it out publicly, to show people what
do? Yeah, it's to get to that point again where we have that grid up and going again. I mean, that's the new Atlantis. You know, this is what, in fact, this is even what Francis Bacon was alluding to in his book, Atlantis. You know, like, we have to develop these technologies and these... and that, by the way, those technologies are also tied in with this AI, a singularity event, where our technology all works.
I mean, it certainly feels like they're all just creeping towards the same.
Totally. But they're all going to be dependent on power, right? They're all going to be dependent on this electricity and this. And again, you know, we're still going into this territory where... it's great. I think it's going to transform our world. It's going to transform consciousness and potential and bring us more together. But on the other hand, it's our Achilles heel, because all it takes is, again, that one solar flare that could wipe it all out.
And we are still on the delicate balance between a form of enlightenment and self-annihilation, because, you know, we are still shit-slinging monkeys with nuclear-tipped missiles. That's what worries me. Is like you said, the spiritual, empathic, conscious development is not at pace with the technological development. And I at this point, because there's no signs of that technological development slowing down, I have to put my chips into this concept that actually we'll develop technologies that can help our spirit and consciousness increase and come back to these states. I mean, if we can develop hemi-sync amplification technologies where you can just induce a meditative state. You know, some people are against this stuff. I was having a little bit of a debate with someone on Twitter who was like, you know, this isn't a natural process. You're removing all the discipline. I was like, I get that, but do you see a mad rush from businessmen and corporate entities towards meditation?
Yeah.
I don't see it. So we need shortcuts. We need fast-acting accelerants. We don't have time to mess around with the discipline of the monk and the priest. It's an admirable feat, but we en masse do not have that time.
So
if we can get technologies that can kind of spark spiritual realization in humanity, like a psychedelic experience that can just be done at the push of a button, dude, I honestly think that could be the key, is that the technology might end up being the thing that actually brings back spirituality.
It can. There's one of my favorite bands is a British band, Lovin' Rockets. they have a song, No New Tale to Tell. And one of the lines in it is, it says, you cannot go against nature.
Right.
Because when you do go against nature, it's part of nature too. And it's kind of, so it's like, that's, exactly. You know, even though we're, what we seem to be doing is going against the natural order. It's really bringing us back to nature, you know.
Yes.
And it's much like what you were talking about with using this AI, starting out trying to develop these technological things to travel places, and then then the AI in itself starts heading towards that philosophical or that spiritual perspective.
Yeah.
That's like, that's where it's all heading.
And, you can't escape it. You can't. It doesn't matter if you're a conscious being in a flesh sack or if you're a coherent artificial AI. You're going back to source, my man. You know.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's fascinating, and I love that quote from that song because I think it's very true actually. Say it again.
It says you cannot go against nature. Because when you do go against nature, it's part of nature too.
Yeah.
Well, tale to tell.
It's the counterintuitive like insight of the human experience. It's like, well, we're ripping up our ozone, we're destroying our planet. But what if this is almost like a placenta that we're consuming before moving on to something else? And I do think about the way in which this could be the planetary natural evolutionary forces finding ways to get off the world and spread even further as a way of propagating through nature. I mean, you know, are we the strange caterpillar that's becoming a butterfly? We're going through this kind of chrysalis, this transformation from a planetary-based consumer munching on the leaves, and just like the caterpillar, here we are consuming all of these natural resources. But the reason why we're doing that is to build the shell, to build the chrysalis, to transform into something that goes off into the cosmos, you know?
Totally, yeah. And I mean, I do think, I hope that as we develop into this, you know, using this new collective consciousness called AI, that it will also bring us back into recognizing how we need to work within the natural order with our planet. I mean, our Earth is an Eden, right? And that we've been given charge of taking care of. I mean, at least if we look at it from a biblical standpoint. And so we need to get back to that Eden to a certain degree where we, you know, we're living within the natural order. We're living in harmony with our animal friends who are part of that. And then utilizing our technology in a way that benefits that, mm-hmm. you know, so that we're not just using up all the resources to escape, but rather we're using the resources to also maintain an order for other life forms that are developing. And I think, once we can figure out how to do that on this planet, then we can do that on other planets as well.
Then
we'll be responsible enough to be able to start heading into the cosmos and going to other worlds.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I do think that there's a level of kind of, it's almost like our position now in evolution, and especially our kind of civilizational architecture, our technology, all of these things we're creating, we're getting to a point where it's no longer safe for us to be doing this on the confines of a planet, because the planet is suffering. The planet is suffering deeply from this. And so the vacuum of space is the only safe place where we can construct these gigantic edifices of human technology and, you know, without it destroying the biosphere and destroying the habitat. So if we want the Eden, I kind of feel like we need to get off the planet, let it heal. And they'll always be shamanic, you know, they'll always be kind of like nomadic and shamanic people that just don't join most of humanity. But I kind of feel like most of us need to get off this planet and let it heal up.
Yeah, totally. There's one of my favorite quotes is by Chief Seattle, who said, the earth doesn't belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. You know, we are a part of this.
Yeah.
We're part of this system, and you know, part of getting off the planet is so that we can colonize other planets or meet with other civilizations that are already out there, have already figured out how to live in harmony with their planets, and build that as the model, for all life to flourish, throughout the universe.
And built into that process, there almost could be, it seems at least, and some people claim very strongly, a cyclical resetting of the planet. You only have X amount of time to become sentient and leave. If you don't do that, it will reset. And it's almost like the planet is a factory for sentient life. And it has like this ability to kind of allow a little bit of cannibalization of the planet, then it resets. And if you're still on the planet when it resets, well, you shouldn't have still been there, buddy. You meant to have gone off and made a Dyson sphere of this.
Right.
What are you doing? So, it could be that we're just, it's just a factory just churning out life, man, churning out life in cycles.
Yeah. The certain Aboriginal traditions in Australia who live very close to the land and who don't develop any technology at all. But the reason why they say they do that is because, and by the way, they're one of the oldest cultures, if you will, on the planet. I mean,
these are the same ones that have the alien gray paintings in the cave.
Yes, exactly.
And
they say their civilization goes, at least their philosophy, goes back 40,000 years. And there's genetic evidence to back that up. But one of the things they say is, they were the remnants of a very advanced civilization, they say, technologically. And through the human selfishness, they abused that technology to the point that they almost destroyed the Earth. And so these people became almost like monks thereafter.
It's like, we're not even going to touch this.
We're not even going to touch technology. We blew it up before. And certainly that's a risk, but I like to believe that this time, we can, if we recognize that's what we did in the past, we can try to move forward this time without making that same mistake. I mean, that's the hope, right? I mean, that's the best of both worlds in that regard. So, or maybe we won't, maybe we'll make the same mistake, but I really feel like those of us who recognize where we've been and where we're going, we have a responsibility to help to wake people up to understand these things so that we're responsible with it as we go there into the future.
Timothy Hogan, my brother, it's been an absolute pleasure, as always.
Yeah, I love chatting with you. And it's always so good to see you. And I love all the work you're doing and your interviews with everybody. I think it's so right on. And I'm looking forward to seeing you do more of it.
Thank you.